Oki Sugimura. Contrary to what most of the class thought, that they were a couple, Hiroki and Takako weren't going out. Hiroki himself told Shinji that. Still, the announcement must have come as a shock to Hiroki. Hiroki, where the hell are you? Shinji decided to concentrate on the present. He closely examined the school below and its surrounding geography. They would have to stretch a rope from here, over the school, and then over to the other side of the zone. Now that he actually had a view of the area, he realized how much distance they'd have to cover. Gazing at the gentle light spilling from the steel-plated windows, Shinji thought, "Damn." That was where Sakamochi and his men were. It was dinner time. For all he knew, they could be eating fried udon. He thought of fried udon because it was his favorite. His uncle used to make it for him when he had Shinji over at a small single-bedroom house, and that was what Shinji wanted so badly to eat right now. Bastards. Shinji and Yutaka already had what they needed. Although it wasn't indicated on the map, which marked it as just another blue dot, Shinji managed to find a farm co-op near the longitudinal road slightly south of the school. The building had a slated roof and walls and bore a sign that read, Northern Takamatsu Agricultural Cooperative Association, Okishima Island Branch. Yutaka was impressed that Shinji's guess about which island they were on had been right. It wasn't your typical farm co-op. It had no real office, nor were there any ATMs. There was only a tractor, combine harvester, and threshing machine scattered inside the warehouse-like space. The only other equipment they found was an office desk taking up one of the corners. Anyway, that was where they found the ammonium nitrate. Fortunately, it was fresh, not at all damp. On top of that, they didn't have to collect gas from cars. They found plenty in the gas containers. The pulley they took from the well next to the house where Shinji had found the Macintosh PowerBook 150, slightly east of the co-op. The other significant item was rope. If they were going to stretch rope across Sector G7, they would need at least 300 meters of it. Furthermore, they would have to roll it out with plenty of slack to escape detection by Sakamochi and his men, so they needed even more. It wasn't going to be easy finding rope that long. The farm co-op had rope, but altogether it was at most 200 meters long and, maybe it was used for a greenhouse or something, too thin, at less than 3 millimeters in diameter, to be reliable. Fortunately, though, they managed to find what appeared to be a private fishing equipment warehouse along the shore south from the harbor, in an area now forbidden along with the residential area. In spite of the fishing rope being weathered from exposure, despite its heavy weight and size, and even though it was over 300 meters long, Shinji and Yutaka managed to divide it up, transport it, and hide it in the farm co-op. Leaving these resources in position, they came up here, to the foot of the northern mountain. Shinji stared into the dark. The foot of the mountain spread out around this side of the school. In other words, the north and west sides. To the left of the school, the woods on the east extended up to the northern side of the residential area and to the seashore. Beyond the school, there were paddy fields. There were clusters of trees here and there, and between them, he could see some houses. Beyond the houses, Shinji could barely make out the farm co-op warehouse where they had left all their equipment. Immediately to the left, the area became gradually crowded with rows of roofs that extended over the border of the forbidden zone and into the residential area. Yutaka tapped Shinji on his right shoulder. Shinji looked to Yutaka, who pulled out his student notepad and began writing something. Before they started moving, Shinji had warned Yutaka with another message that they mustn't give anything away by talking. After all, if Sakamochi and his men found out they were up to no good again, Shinji was sure they wouldn't hesitate to blow their heads off via remote control. He'd already gone over why Sakamochi chose not to detonate his and Yutaka's collar. It was probably because it was best for the game if the students fought each other as much as possible. Shinji had a theory having to do with a rumor he'd heard that high-ranking government officials placed bets on this game. If that were true, then he was sure that he, the star shooting guard of Shiro Iwa Junior High, the third man, must be one of the top seeds. All the more reason why Sakamochi couldn't just finish him off. That was Shinji's hypothesis. Meanwhile, Yoshitoki Kuninobu and Fumio Fujiyoshi were irrelevant players, or to be blunt, no one had placed any bets on them. Still, even if that were true, what a bastard that Kenpachi Sakamoto was. As long as Sakamoto was in charge of this game, he could blow the heads off at any time. Shinji could only pray that wouldn't happen until they managed to bomb the school. Of course, Shinji found the idea despicable. The thought of someone else having so much control over him was entirely revolting to Shinji, who learned from his uncle how to be totally self-reliant for everything in his life. As he looked down at the light from the school, though, he shook his head. That was neither here nor there. He recalled his uncle once telling him, "Don't worry about stuff you can't do anything about. You do what you can, even if your chances of success are less than 1%. Yutaka finished writing his message and handed it to Shinji. Shinji turned away from the view and examined the note under the moonlight. "There's no way we can toss that enormous rope over there. Besides, we left the rope behind. What are we going to do?" He hadn't explained that yet. They'd been too frantic in their search for their equipment. Shinji nodded, took out his pencil, and wrote on the student notepad, "Wire. I brought some. We'll reel out the wire down to the other side and tie it to the rope. Then we'll draw in the rope by pulling the wire right before we execute our plan." He handed the pad over to Yutaka. After reading the note, he looked at Shinji and nodded, as if satisfied. Then he wrote, "You're going to tie a rock to the wire and throw it over there?" Shinji shook his head. Yutaka opened his eyes, surprised. Then, after some thought, he wrote again, "Are you going to make a bow and arrow and shoot the wire across?" Shinji shook his head again. He took the pad and began scribbling. "That might work, but even I can't throw a rock 300 meters, and I can't afford to miss. If the rock hits the school, we're done, and if the wire gets caught somewhere and we end up breaking it, I have a better plan." Yutaka didn't take up his pencil this time and only gazed back at Shinji as if saying, "Huh?" Shinji took the pad and continued, "First, tie the wire to a tree here. Then go down the mountain with the other end of wire. Stretch it taut when we're on the other side." Yutaka read this, but then gave Shinji a skeptical look. He wrote quickly, "You can't do that. It'll get caught in the trees, somewhere in the middle." Shinji grinned. He couldn't blame Yutaka for doubting him. The path they'd taken here was covered with trees, both large and small. Even if they managed to drag the wire out while avoiding G7 and tugged on it later, the wire might get caught. It would make for an odd-looking piece of outdoor contemporary art. "This installation piece is gigantic, but from 5 meters away it appears obscure. The piece addresses the delicate balance between nature and human postmodern industrialism." On top of that, Sector G7 was filled with a dense canopy of forest bordering up to the school. Unless he were a 100-meter-tall giant, and wasn't there a video his uncle had shown him, an old special effects movie where the superhero saves the world by fighting against monsters as they completely tear up the city? They don't make movies like that anymore. You'd have to cut down all the trees if you wanted to put the wire near the school. It was so obvious, and that was why Yutaka insisted it was impossible. But Shinji elegantly spread his arms out. Given how they were on their stomachs, though, the effect wasn't so impressive, and wrote, "How about launching an ad balloon, huh, Yutaka?" Yutaka read the note and knit his brows. Shinji signaled Yutaka to get off the cliff rock and follow him. Once they sat under the rock, he rummaged through his day pack. He pulled out the contents and lined them up on the ground. A half dozen gas canisters, several 100-meter reels of thin fishing wire — that was all he found at the farm co-op — plastic tape, and a box of black plastic garbage bags. Shinji took one of the canisters and showed it to Yutaka. It was painted blue with bright red letters which read, "Voice Changer." Underneath the ad copy read, "Now you'll be the life of the party, huh?" And under that there was an illustration of a duck. Shinji recognized where it came from, based on a Walt Disney character. A whistle-like object was attached to the canister. Shinji wrote, I remembered seeing these at the house where I found the power book. You know what this is? Before taking the pulley, Shinji had gone into the nearby house to retrieve these canisters. What in the world would the occupant of that house do with all these things, though? The files left on the power book's hard drive offered a clue. Given how they had names like fifth grade science or third term report card drafts, the owner of the machine must have been an elementary school teacher. Yes, he was probably one of the real teachers at the school Shinji was targeting. Yutaka touched his throat and opened his mouth. Shinji nodded. Right, it makes you sound like a duck. It's helium, and this one's a defect, so it's still loaded with gas. Yutaka still seemed unconvinced. Shinji thought an actual demonstration would get his point across quicker, so he tore open the pack of garbage bags and pulled out a bag. He opened it up, inserted the canister valve, which was supposed to be sucked into it, and taped it to the bag with the plastic tape. He sealed the edge of the bag with more tape. Then he pressed the valve button and the bag began to inflate. With his finger on the button, Shinji thought, this would be a lot more entertaining with condoms. But even if they had condoms, they would have been a little too small. Huh? Do I have some on me? Well, I mean, come on. This was supposed to be a study trip. Anything can happen, right? You tossed your clothes, but you're still holding on to these? Yeah, I don't know. I do still have them. Well, you never know when they might come in handy. Let's not get into details. After filling up the bag, Shinji twisted the edge right above the canister and sealed it with tape. He took a reel of fishing wire and tied it to the end of the bag. Then he removed the tape below to release it from the canister. Just to be sure, he folded the edge over again, sealing it again with more tape. The garbage bag floated upward. It rose until the wire was taut to the point where it almost seemed to lift the reel, but it stopped right at Shinji and Yutaka's heads. See? Shinji said out loud. Yutaka had probably realized what was going on while Shinji was working on the canister. He'd already nodded several times. Shinji tied another piece of wire from another reel to the wire stretching under the balloon. Just to be sure, he secured this to the balloon with tape. With the pair of wires in both of his hands, he moved the balloon as if it were walking on a pair of legs. Then he pointed to a nearby tree. He moved the string. Yes, in other words, these were the legs of the giant. They were too frail to crush a city, and right now they're shorter than me, but... Yutaka seemed to understand completely. He gave two huge nods. Then he moved his lips without saying anything. It looked like he was saying, Awesome, Shinji. Or maybe it was, Enough already. Whatever, it didn't matter. Shinji took the memo pad and wrote, We make one or two more balloons and attach them to each other, but I still don't know how far up the wire can be stretched. There's also the wind. Let's just go for it. Yutaka read this and nodded. Shinji glanced up at the sky. The bags were black, so even under the moon, Sakamochi and his men wouldn't see them. Right now, there wasn't much wind either. But he had no idea what it was like further up there in the sky. Then he said, Let's hurry. Shinji signaled Yutaka to hold on to the first balloon and proceeded to pull out another garbage bag. 20 students remaining. Chapter 48. Shogo rose a little after 10 p.m. Shuya had been looking after Noriko, who remained resting in bed. Shuya groped through the nearly pitch-black room and entered the waiting room. I'll make some coffee, Shogo said as he looked up at Shuya. Then he walked down the hall. He seemed to have good night vision. Shuya returned to the beds, where he found Noriko up without her blanket. You should rest a little more, Shuya said. Noriko nodded. Uh-huh. Then she mumbled. Could you ask Shogo if he's going to boil some more water if I can get an extra cup? Noriko was sitting on the edge of the bed with her hands by her thighs. Moonlight spilled in over the curtain from the windows. She kept her chin tucked in as she looked over to her side. Sure, but what for? Noriko hesitated and then answered, I sweated so much, I just wanted to wipe down my body. Maybe it's too much to ask for. Oh no, Shuyu replied and quickly nodded. No prob. I'll go tell him. He left the room. Shogo was boiling water in the dark kitchen. The tip of the cigarette between his mouth glowed red, and the charcoal flame under the pot resembled a strange firefly stirring to life. Shogo, Shuyu said. Shogo turned around. The afterimage of his cigarette traced a thick line before vanishing. Noriko was wondering if she could have some hot water. She said one cup was enough. Ah, Shogo didn't let him continue. He removed his cigarette from his mouth. Shuyu could see Shogo was smiling in the dim moonlight coming through the window. Sure, a cup or an entire bucket, fine with me. As he moved, he scooped up water with the bowl from the bucket and added it to the pot. He repeated this 5 times. He kept a low charcoal flame going to keep the water in the pot boiling. Shuyu felt some steam drift by. She's a girl, Shogo said. It turned out Shogo wasn't as slow as Shuyu was. He knew why Noriko asked for hot water. Shuyu was silent, and Shogo unexpectedly continued on his own. She wants to stay pretty because she's with you. And then he exhaled some smoke. Shuyu remained quiet, but then asked, Can I help you? No. Shogo seemed to be shaking his head. Squinting in his eyes, Shuyu could see 3 cups and a coffee dripper already loaded with a filter on the table. There was also a tea bag for Noriko. Shuyu turned back to leave. Hey, Shogo called. Shuyu lifted his brow. What is it? All of a sudden you're so chatty. Shogo chuckled. I understand how you feel about Yoshitoki, but don't forget about Noriko's feelings. Shuyu fell silent again. Then he spoke. For some reason, there was a hint of dissatisfaction in his tone of voice. I know. You have a girlfriend? Shogo proceeded to ask. Shuyu shrugged. Nope. Then what's the problem? Shogo continued to look at the window, smoking his cigarette. It's not a bad thing to be loved. Shuyu shrugged again. Then he asked, Don't you have someone? His cigarette glowed brightly. He didn't say anything. The smoke drifted slowly through the dark. A secret, huh? No. Shogo began to speak, but then he removed the cigarette from his mouth and tossed it into the bucket of water. Get down, Shuyu, he whispered, and crouched down. Shuyu nervously obeyed him. Was someone going to attack? He grew tense. Get Noriko, be quiet though, Shogo whispered again. Shuyu was already on his way to the examination room where Noriko was. Noriko was still sitting in a daze on the edge of the bed. Shuyu signaled her to duck down. She must have immediately understood because she got off the bed, holding her breath. Shuyu offered her his hand for support as they moved to the kitchen. He looked over to the entrance on the way there, but there was no one beyond the glass door. Shogo had already gathered their day packs, which he'd packed with refilled water bottles and other items, and now he was on his knees by the back door, holding his shotgun. What is it? Shuyu asked in a hushed voice. Shogo lifted his left hand to silence him. Shuyu didn't say another word. Someone's outside, Shogo whispered. We'll exit through whichever door they don't enter. The only thing visible in the dark was the bright charcoal flame under the pot. Given the location of the sink, it couldn't be seen from outside. Shuyu heard a tapping sound. It came from the entrance. The door wouldn't open because of the stick jammed against it. The glass was broken, so the person outside must have realized that someone had entered the building and that it was probably still occupied. There was a clacking sound, but then it stopped. It sounded like the person had given up. Shogo groaned. Damn, we'll be in trouble if this one tries to set the place on fire. They remained quiet, but there was still no sound. Then Shogo signaled for them to move toward the entrance. He might have heard a slight sound. They were nearly crawling down the hall. As they made their way, Shogo, behind the other two, reached out to Shuyu, who was leading. They stopped. Shuyu turned around and looked over his shoulder at Shogo. He's circling back to the front. He waved his hand to the back. Let's go out the back. So they went toward the kitchen down the hall. Shogo stopped again before they entered the kitchen.
Damn, why?
He muttered. The person outside was now coming round to the back door again. The silence continued. Shogo held on to his shotgun. With Noriko between him and Shogo, Shuya also gripped the Sig Sauer that had once belonged to Kaori Minami. He'd given the Smith & Wesson to Shogo. Shuya decided to hold on to the gun that had more bullets. But the silence was suddenly broken. A voice called from outside the kitchen window.
"It's Hiroki," he said. "I'm not fighting. Respond, you three. Who are you?"
It was undoubtedly the voice of Hiroki Sugimura, male student number 11, who along with Shinji Mamura was one of the few classmates Shuya could trust.
"What the?" Shuya gasped. "That's incredible."
It was a stroke of luck. He never thought they'd see Hiroki. Shuya and Noriko looked at each other. Noriko looked relieved. Shogo stopped Shuya as he tried to get up.
"What?"
"Shh, don't raise your voice."
Shuya stared at Shogo's serious expression and then responded with an exaggerated shrug and smiled.
"Don't worry, I'll vouch for him. We can totally trust him."
Shogo shook his head and said, "How did he know there were three of us?" That thought hadn't occurred to Shuya. He thought it over while looking at Shogo. But he had no idea. That didn't matter, though. The important thing was that Hiroki was here. He just wanted to see Hiroki's face now.
Maybe he saw us go in here from far away. That's why he didn't know who we were.
What took him so long to get here, then?
Shuya thought again. He probably deliberated over whether he should find out who was here or not.
In any case, we can trust Hiroki. I'll vouch for him.
Shuya ignored Shogo, who looked like he wasn't satisfied. He raised his voice and directed it beyond the window.
"It's Shuya, Hiroki. I'm with Shogo Kawada and Noriko Nakagawa."
"Shuya!"
A relieved voice replied.
"Let me in. Where should I come in?"
Before Shuya could answer, Shogo raised his voice.
"This is Shogo. Go to the front entrance. Keep your hands behind your head and do not move. Got that? Shogo."
Shuya was about to protest, but Hiroki immediately responded.
"Got it!"
What looked like the upper body of Hiroki crossed the frosted glass window. Shogo bent down to look through the cracks in the glass. Holding his shotgun, he yanked out the obstructing stick and opened the door. Hiroki Sugimura was standing with his hands behind his neck. He was slightly taller than Shogo, but more slender. His hair, wavy like Shuya's, came down to the middle of his forehead. His day pack was by his feet, and for some reason there was a 1.5-meter stick on the ground. It was true. Shuya shifted his eyes as if it were a miracle. Shuya's face made Hiroki grin.
"I have to do a body check."
"Shogo, come on."
Shogo paid no attention to Shuya's protest and moved forward, holding on to his shotgun. He went behind Hiroki and first checked his hands behind his neck. Then he rubbed his left hand over Hiroki's school coat. His hand stopped at a pocket.
"What the hell's this?"
"Go ahead and pull it out," Hiroki said with his hands held together. "But give it back to me."
Shogo pulled it out. It was the size and shape of a thick notepad, but it was made of plastic or steel. The cover panel reflected the moonlight. After fiddling around with it, Shogo said,
"Aha."
He moved his body with the object in his hands and then looked down at the cover panel against the moonlight. He nodded and returned it to Hiroki's pocket. Then he thoroughly searched Hiroki down to his pant cuffs. He also checked his day pack and finally announced,
"Okay, sorry about that. You can put your hands down."
Hiroki unlocked his hands and picked up his day pack and stick. The stick appeared to be his weapon.
"Hiroki."
Shuya broke into a smile.
"Come on in. We have coffee. You want some?"
Hiroki nodded somewhat hesitantly as he went through the entrance. Shogo looked outside and then shut the door. Hiroki stood still. With his back to the shoe cabinet that was filled with slippers, Shogo stared at Hiroki. The Remington muzzle was pointed down, but Shuya noticed Shogo's finger still on the trigger and felt slightly annoyed. He did his best not to let it get to him, though.
Hiroki looked at Shuya and Noriko again and then glanced over at Shogo. That was when Shuya realized that Hiroki was troubled not so much by him and Noriko, but by their hooking up with Shogo. Shogo addressed the issue. Shuya, Hiroki seems to want to ask whether it's all right for you guys to be with me. Hiroki smiled slightly at Shogo and said, No, I just thought it was an odd combination. Shuya would never be with you if you were hostile. Shuya can be pretty stupid when it comes to certain things, but he's not that stupid. Shogo responded with a grin, though he still kept his finger on the trigger. In any case, Hiroki and Shogo were finished introducing themselves for now. Ah, come on, Hiroki. Shuya gave him a smile. Then Noriko said, Come on in. It's not our house, so I can't apologize for its messiness. Then Hiroki smiled, but he stayed at the entrance. Shuya supported Noriko with his left hand and then pointed at the hall. Come on in. We'll have to get going soon, but we have a little time. We'll throw you a welcoming party. But Hiroki still stood there. Shuya realized how he'd forgotten to share an important detail. Hiroki might have been appalled Shuya was using the word party in this situation. Hiroki, we can get out of here. Shogo is going to help us. Hiroki's eyes widened a little. Really? Shuya nodded, but then Hiroki looked down. Then he looked up again. Thing is, he said, and shook his head, there's something I have to take care of. Something? Shuya knit his brows. Why don't you first come on in? Instead of taking Shuya up on his invitation, he asked, Have you three been together all this time? Shuya thought it over and then shook his head. No, well, me and Noriko were, and then... Then he remembered what happened this morning. It had been a while since the image of Tatsumichi Oki's skull split open had assaulted him, and once again he felt the chill run down his spine. Yeah, a lot of stuff happened, and we ended up joining Shogo. I see. Hiroki nodded and then said, Hey, have you guys seen Kotohiki? Kotohiki? Shuya repeated. Kayoko Kotohiki, female student number 8? The one who, in spite of being into tea ceremony, seemed more playful than elegant? No. Shuya shook his head. We haven't, but... He thought of Shogo and looked over at him, but Shogo also shook his head and said, I haven't seen her either. Of course, Kayoko Kotohiki had to be on this island. As long as her name wasn't announced yet in Sakamochi's announcements, she had to be alive. Unless she'd been killed after 6 p.m., Once again, Shuya realized how he was letting most of his classmates die and felt awful. What about Kotohiki? Noriko asked. Oh, Hiroki shook his head. It's no big deal. Thanks. Sorry, but I have to get going. He gave Shuya a parting glance and turned to go. Hold on, Hiroki. Shuya stopped him. Where are you going? I told you you're safe with us, didn't I? Hiroki looked back at Shuya. There was a sad look in his eyes, but they still gave away that humorous trace of irony. It might have been a look all his close friends shared. Yoshitoki Kuninobu, deceased, damn. And of course Shinji Mamura and, now it seemed, Shogo Kawada. I have to see Kayoko Kotohiki about something, so I have to go. Something. What could that possibly be in this situation where moving around would only increase your chances of dying? Finally, Shuya said, Hold on. You can't go, not without any real weapons. It's too risky. And how are you going to find her? Hiroki bit his lower lip. Then he pulled out that object resembling a mobile data terminal from his pocket and showed it to Shuya. This is the weapon I got in my day pack. Professor Kawada over there could explain. He pointed at his neck while his hand held the device. The silver collars around the necks of Shuya, Noriko, and Shogo were all shining. Looks like this device detects anyone wearing these collars. Once someone's in the vicinity, they show up on the screen, but you can't tell whose collar is whose. Shuya finally figured out the answer to Shogo's questions. It was thanks to this device Hiroki had been able to know there were 3 of them and detect their movements. Like the computer at the school monitoring their positions, it could detect the position of anyone wearing a collar,
even if, as Hiroki said, you couldn't tell who it was. Hiroki put the device back into the pocket.
See you.
He was ready to go when he suddenly stopped.
Oh, one more thing.
Beware of Mitsuko Sauma, he added. He gave Shuya and then Shogo a stern look.
She's playing the game.
I don't know about the others, but I know for sure she is.
Did you fight her? Shogo asked.
Hiroki shook his head.
No.
I didn't, but Takako Chikusa said so before she died.
Mitsuko killed Takako.
Shuya suddenly recalled how Takako was already dead. After hearing Sakamochi announce her death, he'd been concerned about its effect on Hiroki, but he was so happy to see him, he'd forgotten this dreadful fact. Hiroki and Takako Chikusa had been close. For a while, Shuya actually thought they were going out. But when he'd casually asked him about it, Hiroki chuckled and said, "She's in a different class. We've known each other since we were kids. You know, hide-and-seek, that kind of thing. When we used to fight, I'd be the one crying." Of course, Takako Chikusa was an amazing athlete and pretty aggressive, but her taking on Hiroki, who was now over 180 centimeters tall and ranked in martial arts. A while back, the only time Shuya visited his house, Hiroki reluctantly showed him how he could split a piece of pine wood with the palm of his hand. Just sounded preposterously funny. But now Takako Chikusa was dead, and given the way Hiroki had just described it, he was there when she died.
"So you were with her?"
Noriko asked quietly. Hiroki shook his head.
"Just at the very end,
when we left, I hid in front of the school, waiting for her. But then Yoshio came back, and I got too distracted, so I lost Takako. Then, as I looked for Takako, I ended up losing my chance to join you, Shuya, or Shinji." Shuya nodded several times. So Hiroki was in front of the school until Yoshio Akamatsu returned. He probably hid in the woods.
It was dangerous, of course, but that only showed how important Takako was to Hiroki.
"But," Hiroki continued, "I found Takako. I was too late, though."
Saying this much, Hiroki looked down. He shook his head several times. Without being told, Shuya understood that by the time Hiroki had found Takako, she was dying. Shuya thought of telling him how Yoshio Akamatsu had killed Mayumi Tendo, and how he had almost killed Shuya as well. But it was irrelevant now. Yoshio Akamatsu was dead now too.
"I don't know what to say, but I'm so sorry," Noriko said.
Hiroki smiled a little and nodded.
"Thanks."
"In any case," Shuya said, "come on in. Let's talk it over. What's the..."
He meant to say rush, but refrained. If Hiroki wanted to see Kayoko Kotohiki while they were both still alive, what else could he do but rush? While Hiroki's connection to Takako Chigusa was clear, Shuya had no idea why it was so important for him to find Kayoko Kotohiki. But in any case, as they sat here talking, she could be fighting someone, or she might even be dying. She could be dead. Hiroki grinned. It seemed he knew what Shuya was thinking. Shuya licked his lips. He glanced over at Shogo and then said, "If you insist." He looked at Hiroki. "We'll find her with you." But Hiroki flatly refused. He pointed his chin at Noriko.
"Noriko's injured. It's too dangerous."
"No."
Shuya found the situation unbearable. "But you could be saved with us. How are we going to meet again if you leave?"
Once they separated, it would be nearly impossible for them to meet again.
"Hiroki,"
it was Shogo. He still held the shotgun, but his finger wasn't on the trigger anymore. Hiroki looked over at him, and Shogo pulled out something small from his pocket with his open hand. He lifted it to his mouth and bit on its metal end, twisting it. It made the chirping sound of a bird. It was a loud, brilliant, and playful sound, like a robin or chickadee. Shogo released his hand from his mouth, and Shuya realized that it was Shogo's device. A bird call? Forget why he would have one in the first place. It was one of those things that mimicked the sound of birds chirping. "Whether you meet Kayoko Kotohiki or not," Shogo said. "If you want to see us, make a fire somewhere and burn raw wood to get some smoke going. Make two fires. Of course, leave as soon as you make them because you'll only attract attention. And make sure you don't cause a fire. Once we see that, we'll make this call every 15 minutes, say, for 15 seconds. Try to find us by following this sound." He pointed to the bird call. "This sound is your ticket out of here. If you're up for it, you can come aboard our train." Hiroki nodded. "Okay, I will. Thanks." Shogo took out his map. He unfolded it and handed the map and his pencil over to Hiroki. "Also, I'm sorry for keeping you, but I need you to mark where Takako was killed. If you saw anyone else, I need to know those locations too." Hiroki lifted his brow slightly as he took the map. He spread the map out on the shoe cabinet, under the moonlit window, and held the pencil. "Give me your map. I'll write in the locations of the bodies we know," Shogo said. Hiroki stopped writing and handed over his map. The two began marking the maps side by side. "I'll bring some coffee over," Noriko said, and left Shuya's arm. She limped down the hall, using the wall as support. "Did Takako say whether Matsuko had a machine gun?" Shogo asked as he wrote. "No," Hiroki answered without lifting his eyes. "She didn't say anything about that. I do know that she was shot several times. It wasn't a single bullet." "I see." As the two proceeded, Shuya described the fates of Yoshio Akamatsu, Tatsumichi Oki, and Kyoichi Motobuchi. Hiroki nodded as he continued to write. Shogo was done marking Hiroki's map. He pointed at it and explained, "This is where Kaori Minami was killed. Shuya saw Hirono Shimizu escape. She might have done it in self-defense. But either way, you should be careful." Hiroki nodded. Then unexpectedly he said, "I saw Kaori too," and pointed at the map. "Before noon. She fired at me, but I think she was in a panic." Shogo nodded and exchanged Hiroki's map with his. Noriko came out into the hall, walking unsteadily and holding a cup. Shuya went down the hall and took it from her. He offered it to Hiroki, who took a sniff, whistled lightly, and then held it. "Thanks," he said, and took a sip. Then he put the cup on the raised entrance floor. It was nearly full. "I'll see ya." "Hold on." Shuya pulled out his six-hour from under his belt. With its grip pointed at Hiroki, he offered it to him. He also pulled out an extra cartridge from his pocket. "If you still insist on going, take these, okay? We have a shotgun and one more gun." The first gun was Kyoichi Motobuchi's, and the Smith & Wesson was now with Shogo. Shuya's handing over the six-hour gun would decrease their fighting capacity, but Shogo didn't intervene. But Hiroki shook his head. "You need that, Shuya. You better protect Noriko, all right? I can't take that. Even if someone attacks me, I just can't do it." He tilted his head and then examined both Shuya and Noriko. He broke into a slight grin and then added, "I always wondered why you two weren't going out." Then he nodded at each of them and quietly opened the entrance door. "Hiroki," Noriko called. Her voice was quiet. "Be careful." "I will. Hey, thanks. And best of luck to you guys." "Hiroki," Shuya managed to say, though he was getting choked up. "We'll meet again. That's a promise." Hiroki nodded and left. Shuya held Noriko and stepped through the front entrance, watching Hiroki as he quickly ascended the mountain. Without a word, Shogo gestured to Shuya and Noriko to move back and close the door. Shuya took a deep breath and turned around. He could barely see the steam still rising from the cup Hiroki had left on the floor. 20 students remaining. Chapter 49. The moon was high in the center of the sky. There wasn't a single cloud. The white light from the nearly full moon cast a thin film over the rest of the sky, obscuring the stars. Shogo, who was leading, stopped. Shuyo, who was supporting Noriko with his shoulder, stopped too.
"Are you all right?" Shuyo asked Noriko. She nodded.
"I'm fine." But Shuyo could tell she was still weak. Shuyo looked at his watch. It was past 11 p.m. now, but they'd already left G9, which was now a forbidden zone. They had to find another place to settle down. They were tracing their way back along the foot of the northern mountain. The area was scattered with trees. A little further down, and they'd be near where Kaori Minami was killed. Immediately to their left, Shuyo saw a flat, narrow area that extended from the island's residential area on the eastern shore. The plateau, spotted with houses, then became increasingly narrow, like a triangle. According to the map, the road traversing the island passed through this pivot and headed to the western shore. Shogo turned around. "Now what do we do?" Noriko's blanket was tied to the top of the day pack on his shoulder. "Can we stop at a house, like we just did now?"
"A house, huh?"
Shogo looked away from Shuya and squinted.
"It's really not a good idea. As the number of zones decreases, so does the number of houses. The moment someone needs something, they'll want to enter a house, whether it's to eat or whatever."
"Hey, if you're worried about me, I'm fine now, even outside," Noriko said. Shogo flashed a smile and then silently looked over the flatland. He took Hiroki's marks on his map into consideration as he took in the view. Along with the bodies he'd seen, Hiroki had given detailed explanations of how they had died. The body of Kazushi Niida was near where Takako Chiguza had died. Along with his eyes being gouged out, his throat had been stabbed. In the residential area that was now forbidden was Megumi Ito. Her throat had been slashed by a blade. Shuya felt a pang in his chest over this one, since Noriko had told him how Megumi had a crush on him. To the east, Yoji Kurimoto and Yoshimi Yahagi were killed where the eastern shore's residential area met the southern mountain. Yoji was stabbed in the head, and Yoshimi had been shot. At the southern tip, Izumi Kanai, Hiroshi Kurinaga, Ruhei Sasagawa, and Mitsuru Numai were all found dead together. Mitsuru Numai was shot several times, while the others' throats were slashed. Three of Kuriyama's group had died together, the only exception being Shotsuki Yoka, who got caught in a forbidden zone.
"Shogo," Shuya said. Shogo looked back.
"Do you think Mitsuko-sama killed Yukiko and Yumiko?" Even now, as he asked this, it all felt so unreal. He didn't believe a girl could do such horrible things. Of course he had no doubt, since it was Hiroki who'd informed them, but he still couldn't restrain the urge to dismiss it all as a delusion.
"No," Shogo shook his head. "I don't think so. After Yukiko and Yumiko got killed by that machine gun, you know how we heard pistols going off? That was to finish them off. But Hiroki said Takako was alive after being shot when he found her, which means her killer wasn't as thorough. Of course, she might have let Takako go, knowing she was going to die anyway. But given the times and locations, I just don't think Mitsuko-sama's the one with the machine gun." Shuyu recalled the machine gun fire he heard before 9 a.m. The killer was still roaming around the island. And the distant gunfire they heard a little afterwards, was that Mitsuko-sama? "Eventually, we'll..." Shogo forced a grin and shook his head. "Meet him or her. Then we'll know for sure." Shuyu recalled something else that had been bugging him. "When Hiroki showed us his radar, I was thinking how Sakamochi must know we're together and what our possessions are." Shogo answered as he surveyed the flatland.
"Yeah." Shuyu moved his shoulder to give Noriko better support.
"Won't that hinder our escape?"
Shogo chuckled with his back to Shuyu.
"Nope, not at all. Don't worry."
Shogo looked over the flatland again and said, "Let's go back to where we were." He continued, "A common strategy players in this game take is to show up anywhere they hear some action. That's because of the 24-hour deadline. Because of that limitation, they kill when they can. And the fact that they're on a killing spree means they're on their own, so they can't afford to sleep much. So the match has to be kept short. If something happens near them, they go there. and if there's a fight already going on, they sit back and then they finish off any survivors. That's why we should stay somewhere we can avoid confrontations. If we get mixed up with someone who's panicking, then one of the top players is bound to show up. If we go back where we were, it's unlikely we'll meet anyone. Since Tatsumichi Oki and Kyoichi Motobuchi, who'd been hiding there, are no longer around, that area is pretty much uninhabited. But Hirono ran in that direction. No, I doubt she's gone that far. It wouldn't be necessary. Shogo pointed to the flatland with his thumb. But we'll avoid this mountain where she might be hiding. We'll take a different route. Shuyi lifted his brow. Is it safe for us to move through the flatland? Shogo said, The moon may be shining, but this isn't daylight. I think we're safer there than on the mountain where there's too much cover. Shuyi nodded. Shogo took the lead and began descending the slope. Shuyi held the 6-hour tightly in his right hand, supported Noriko in his left, and followed Shogo. The trees turned into a field of short grass. The first farm they came across had a field full of squashes. Beyond this field, there was a wheat field. The island was so small, these probably weren't for domestic consumption. Of course, the Republic of Greater East Asia was incessantly issuing orders to promote national self-reliance, so even a small farm like this might contribute a little to that effort. As they moved along the edge of the farm, the soil under their sneakers felt dry. Maybe it was because several days had passed since the area had been evacuated. Still, Shuyi was struck by the pleasant, rich odor of wheat drifting through the evening air, anticipating the summer. It was a nice smell, especially after having smelled so much blood. There was a tractor to their left. Beyond the vehicle, there was a house. It was an ordinary 2-story house and appeared relatively new. It was probably one of those cheap, mass-produced buildings resembling a banana home or vertebrae house. Even though it was in the middle of the farm, it was enclosed by a concrete wall. Shuyi looked at Shogo's back as he moved forward. Something irked him. He looked back. Noriko was leaning on his left shoulder as she walked, but he noticed something high above her head in the middle of the sky. Something flashing in the moonlight, tracing an arc. This object came flying at them. 20 students remaining. Chapter 50. What made Shuya such a star athlete in his little league days was his incredible ability to perceive objects in motion. Even in this dim light, Shuya could tell that the object flying toward them right now resembled a can. Of course, they were in the serene Sito Inland Sea region, so it couldn't possibly be an empty can falling from the sky from a hurricane. There was no way it was an empty can. No. Shuya suddenly released his shoulder, which was tucked under Noriko's right armpit. He couldn't even afford to call on Shogo, who must have realized something odd, though, because he also suddenly turned around. Noriko tottered without Shuya's support. Shuya dashed out. His jumping ability was quite extraordinary. Just as in the past, during the Little League prefectural semifinals, he could make the ultimate play from any given position, stealing the opponent's winning home run in the bottom of the 11th inning. Shuya caught the ball, no, the can, in midair with his left hand. He put it in his right hand, and as he came down, he twisted his body and threw it as far as he could. Before Shuya landed, a bright light shone through the night. He felt the air burst as a sonic boom tore through his eardrums. The bomb blast blew him away before he could land, and he fell sprawling onto the ground. If he'd waited for the hand grenade to fall, he, Noriko, and Shogo would have all been mincemeat now. Although Sakamochi's crew might have reduced the grenade's explosive power so that it couldn't be used against the school, it was more than capable of killing human beings. He raised his head. He realized he heard nothing. His ears were screwed up. In this state of silence, Shuya saw Noriko collapsed on his left. Then he lifted his face to look back at Shogo and saw another can flying at them.
Another one. I have to.
But it was too late now. His disabled ears all of a sudden heard a definite but muffled bang. almost simultaneously followed by another explosion in the air. This sound was also muffled, but this time it felt a little further off and Shuyo wasn't blown away. Right beside him, Shogo was on one knee, holding his shotgun. He had shot the hand grenade, as if he were skeet shooting, blowing it to bits before it managed to explode. Shuyo ran over to Noriko and held her up. She was grimacing. She seemed to be moaning, but he couldn't hear her.
Shuyo, get back!
Shogo waved his hand and fired his shotgun with his right hand. Shuyo then heard a different sound, rattling gunfire, and the wheat hedge right in front of him scattered into the air. Shogo fired another two shots. In a state of confusion, Shuyo pulled Noriko into the shade of the ridge marking off the farm. He got down. Shogo slid to his side, firing several shots as he went. The rattling continued, and the ridge soil blew up, grains flying into his eyes. Shuyo pulled out his Sig Sauer and looked out from the shade of the ridge. He fired blindly in the direction Shogo was firing. Then he saw him, less than 30 meters away, that head of unique, slicked-back hair behind the break in the house's concrete wall. It was Kazuo Kurayama, male student number 6. And although Shuyo's hearing was impaired, he could recall the sound of the rattling gunfire. It was the same sound he heard in the distance when Yumiko and Yukiko fell at the northern mountain peak. Of course, he might not be the only one with a machine gun. But even so, Kazuo, who was right in front of their very own eyes, had just tried to kill them without warning, with, of all things, a hand grenade. Shuyo was certain Kazuo was the one who'd murdered Yumiko and Yukiko. He thought of how they were killed and felt a flash of rage.
What the hell's he doing? Stop shouting, just shoot!
Shogo handed the Smith & Wesson to Shuyo and reloaded his shotgun. Shuyo held a gun in each hand and began shooting at the concrete wall.
Two-hand shooter, this is crazy!
First the Smith & Wesson, then the Sig Sauer ran out of bullets. He had to reload. Having waited for this moment, Kazuo got up.
Brrrrata!
Sparks flew out from him. Shuyo ducked, and Kazuo revealed part of his body that was behind the wall. Shogo blasted his shotgun away. Kazuo's body once again vanished. The swarm of shotgun pellets blew off part of the wall. Shuyo ejected the empty magazine from his Sig Sauer and pulled out a loaded magazine from his pocket. He opened the Smith & Wesson cylinder and pushed the rod in the center of the cylinder to release its spent shells, puffed up from the explosions. One of the shells nearly singed part of his right thumb. It didn't matter. He quickly loaded the .38 caliber bullets Shogo had rolled over his way. Then he aimed at Kazuo's house. Shogo shot again, blowing off another part of the wall. Shuyo also fired several shots into it with his Sig Sauer.
Noriko, are you all right? Shuyo yelled.
Right next to him, Noriko answered,
I'm okay.
He could make out her response, which made Shuyo realize his hearing was back. He saw her in the corner of his eye reloading 9mm short bullets into the Sig Sauer's empty magazine. Of all the things he'd seen since the game began, this one really sent his head reeling. How could a girl like Noriko be participating in a battle like this? A hand, holding the machine gun, appeared from the other side of the wall. It fired another burst. Shuyo and Shogo ducked. Kazuo got up. As he continued shooting, he came forward. Then he ran behind the tractor. The distance between them was shrinking. Shogo fired a shot, blowing off the tractor's driving panel.
Shogo!
Shuyo called after shooting twice.
What?
Shogo answered as he reloaded his shotgun.
How fast can you run the 100-meter dash?
Shogo took another shot, annihilating the tractor's rear light, and answered,
I'm pretty slow. Maybe 13 seconds. My back's strong, though. Why?
Suddenly, Kazuo's arm stuck out from behind the tractor. Sparks flew as Kazuo revealed his head, but as Shuyo and Shogo fired back, he ducked again.
We can only retreat into the mountain, right?
Shuyo spoke quickly.
I can run 100 meters in just under 11 seconds. You and Noriko go ahead. I'll keep Kazuo there.
Shogo glanced at Shuyo. That was all. He understood.
At the place we were earlier, Shuyo. The place where we talked about rock, Shogo said quickly.
He gave Shuya his shotgun and retreated into a ducking position. He moved around over to Noriko. Shuya took a deep breath and shot three times into the tractor with the shotgun, prompting Shogo to lift Noriko and run in the direction they'd come from. Noriko's eyes flashed by Shuya's for a moment. Kazuo's upper body appeared from behind the tractor. Shuya fired his shotgun several times. Kazuo, who had his gun pointed at Shogo and Noriko, ducked. Shuya realized he was out of shotgun shells, so he picked up the Smith & Wesson instead and began shooting again. He immediately used up 5 bullets. He opened the 6-hour and loaded the extra magazine Noriko had prepared and began shooting again. It was crucial he keep on shooting. He saw Shogo and Noriko disappear into the mountain. The 6-hour was empty, and there were no more extra magazines. He could only reload bullets. But then this time Kazuo's arm appeared from behind the tractor's blade. The Ingram machine gun rattled away. Just like before, Kazuo was up and running toward him. Shuya had to get out of this gunfight. He held on to only the empty 6-hour. He still had 7 more individual 9mm bullets. Turned around and ran. If he could reach the mountain where there was plenty of cover, Kazuo wouldn't be able to get too close to him. Shuya decided to head east. Noriko and Shogo would be headed west to get where they were yesterday. He wanted to lead Kazuo as far away from them as he could. It all came down to his sprinting speed. He had to get as far away from Kazuo as possible in a short span of time. A machine gun delivered showers of bullets, so it was impossible to dodge at a close distance. What mattered was how far he could get. Shuya ran. As the fastest runner in the class, he could only rely on speed. At least he thought he was the fastest. He was even a fraction of a second faster than Shinji Mamura. But what if Kazuo wasn't really trying during his test? When he was about 5 meters away from the first of the trees, he heard a rattling sound. He felt a severe blow against the left side of his stomach. Shuya groaned as he began losing his balance, but he kept on running. He ran into a row of tall trees and made his way up the slope. The rattling resumed, and this time his left arm reflexively flinched up. He realized he'd been shot right above his elbow. But he still ran. He continued east. "Hey, yo, that's a forbidden zone." And moved north, more rattling. A thin tree to his right crackled and burst into matchstick-sized splinters. More rattling. This time he wasn't hit. Or maybe he was. He couldn't tell anymore. He only knew he was being chased. At least he was buying time for Noriko and Shogo. He made his way through the trees and vegetation, climbed a hill, and then descended it. He couldn't even afford to worry that there might be someone else hiding in the dark, waiting to attack him. He had no idea how far he'd gotten. He wasn't even sure which direction he was running. Sometimes it seemed like he could hear the rattling sound, and sometimes it seemed like he couldn't. He couldn't tell. Maybe because his hearing had been impaired by that explosion. In any case, now was not the time to be relieved. Move. He had to keep moving. Suddenly, Shuya slipped. He'd somehow reached a cliff, and all of a sudden, the slope just dropped off. Just as he'd done when fighting Tatsumichi Oki, he tumbled down the steep slope. He landed with a thud. He was no longer holding the 6-hour. And as he tried to stand up, he realized he couldn't. He wondered, in a daze, "Am I delirious from blood loss? Did I hit my head? Impossible. I'm not injured so badly I can't stand up. I have to get back to Noriko and Shogo. I have to protect Noriko. I promised Noriko." As he tried to get up, though, he fell forward and lost consciousness. 20 students remaining. Chapter 51. It was almost pitch dark, but beside the dimly moonlit window, Shinji tossed the item in his hand once again to the floor. The sound of it hitting the floor was muffled by the thick folded blanket, but there was a popping sound along with a ring. Shinji immediately picked it up off the floor and then tucked the small plastic item inside the blanket. The sound stopped. "Come on, let's go," Yutaka said. He'd been watching over Shinji, but Shinji signaled him to calm down.
He repeated the test again. Pop, zing. It made the same sounds. Shinji picked it up, and it stopped. Was it all right?